right, welcome back to AI What the Tech Season 2, Episode 1. I am Bhaskar, recording from my new home in Minnesota, where the weather's been absolutely glorious lately. Crisp, clear skies, just that kind that makes you want to open the windows and feel inspired. Now, Sean, are you excited to launch this season with me?
I am excited. I'm Sean Huss. I'm still in Arkansas. As of last week, it was 100 plus degrees. It's actually gotten cool fairly recently. So there's that. But, you know, we're in what we call false fall.
Right. Yeah, we're in that as well. It's been a little chilly.
It's going to jump back up here in a couple of weeks.
And to our listeners, if you're enjoying our conversation, help us keep them going by supporting the show at buymeacoffee.com/AIWhatTheTech. Every coffee fuels our ideas and keeps the podcast buzzing. You want to tell our audience where they can also catch us at?
You can catch us on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, if you want to look at us. I know a lot of people have started going to YouTube, so we're on all major platforms pretty much. Make sure you put in AI, What the Tech to find us.
Question mark, exclamation mark, all caps. And please do subscribe because it really means a lot to us. With that being said, I'm super excited to introduce our guest for today.
Absolutely. So our guest today is Dr. Amber N. Yu, DBA. She is a business professor and industry leader who helps universities and executives adopt generative AI, both practically and ethically. Known for clear, non-technical explanations and for championing responsible use in business and academia, she presented at the Academy of Management in 2024 and in 2025, mostly over potential to advance management research with AI and course design for teaching generative AI. She also was at the Florida conference that we've run. That was the UF AI Squared. There, she spoke on the need for academic innovation in the age of AI. At Vanguard University, she designed and teaches Introduction to Generative AI. At California State University, San Marcos, she chairs the College of Business AI Task Force and serves on the C-STEM AI Committee. She leads nationwide faculty workshops and is authoring a generative AI course textbook slated for spring 2026. In San Diego, Modern Luxury Magazine named her an innovative leader. Outside of academia, Amber is the co-founder of Sky Facial Plastic Surgery and the parent of a seven-year-old who loves using ChatGPT as a reading tutor and storyteller. So
that's cool. So with that being said, let's have Amber on the show. Well, hello, Amber. Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate you taking the time. This is something really important and, everybody needs to have that conversation. So I appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I wanted to kick off with a story that captures how AI isn't just changing education, but it's almost demanding that we act like right now. Today in Tamil Nadu, India, the government rolled out an AI-powered skill registry to better connect youth with recruiters, responding to dramatically low enrollments and poor placement outcomes. And it's a powerful reminder that policy and practice need to kind of move together, especially when the urgency is so clear, right? Even with national guidance now emphasizes like building policy supports and classroom practices together with human oversight, this just isn't about abstract debates anymore, isn't it, Sean?
I agree. All these issues are kind of coming to a head at this point. People are trying to get their heads around them. So I think that's why Amber's here. We're going to try to talk about it. And if AI is already here, related to higher ed, what structural changes must higher ed make now to stay relevant in the face of all these radical sort of revolutions?
Yeah, I think that's what we need to be grappling with and moving the conversation forward. So often I'm still sensing that we're having conversations that are a little bit more fear-based among educators and higher ed leadership, and I'm ready to move forward. And I think a lot of universities are ready to move forward as well.
No, I was going to ask, like, you know, have you had that difficult conversation with anybody where they don't want to use AI, but, you're showing them that there are better ways of them doing their work? Have you had that uncomfortable conversation with somebody would be my question.
With educators, I think that probably I'm in rooms and in spaces where the people who opt into those rooms are more embracing of AI. But even in passing, so for example, at one of the colleges I teach at, two different weeks, last week and this week, I just ran into another faculty member and they're like, oh, you know, what do you teach? And I said, oh, I teach generative AI. And they're like, wow, so cool. And the reaction was different than I think what I would have gotten, you know, maybe even last semester, right? Mm-hmm. I got a, wow, that's great. And I'm glad that our university is offering that. Also, I did some research for an initiative that I'm looking into yesterday. And here in the San Diego, California area, there's two AI centers that College of Businesses are putting out, which is great. I like to see that. There's several, there's at least three undergrad degrees that are now AI focused as well. And that was just California. I'm sure that's happening across the state. One of the things that I think is rolled into the motivation for that is it appears that AI is one of the only safe areas for funding in today's administration.
Right. That's very interesting. Yep. And I'm sure like other universities and other states are picking up on that as well. And everybody's going towards this AI center of excellence idea, and they want an AI center in their state or in their university as well. Right, Sean, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I mean, we want one. I don't know if it'll happen, but we certainly try to move the ball in that direction. And in our conversations, even just on policy, we keep pointing out that as we write the policy, we're going to have to set up some sort of centralized system within the university, not only to govern the policy, but to move toward university-specific self-enclosed sort of AI systems to be up to snuff with everyone else. So to get it, you know, start developing our own. So That's where our conversations go.
And that kind of segments us into preparing students for the workforce. And I was kind of going over a few statistics. 66% of leaders wouldn't hire someone without AI skills. 71% would hire a less experienced candidate with AI skills over a more experienced candidate without them, which is something kind of worrying. I read a few other snapshots as well. Times of India survey reports that 60% of 2026 US graduates are actually pessimistic about their job prospects, citing AI as a major source of uncertainty. Now, that lines up with what we know across sectors, like HR professionals say AI skills are critically lacking in the workforce, and the workers themselves are feeling the pressure. So AI isn't just future looking, right? It's right now, right? It needs to happen right now.
Right. And then just to underscore the gap that's taking place in higher education, 50% of university leaders say that their schools aren't adequately preparing students for the workplace with AI. So I think that we're behind the eight ball. I've been saying that for quite a while now. And I'm glad that there are other people that seem to be feeling the same way and wanting to move forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's that the push is there, the need is there. It's just the way that we can start designing the courses, designing our applications to kind of meet that course, meet that requirement. Yeah.
I agree. And I think that a top down is also necessary, mm-hmm. as well as the bottom up. Right. So I think that it first has to start with university leadership saying, hey, this is the direction we're going. We want to stay on the cutting edge of this. We need to serve our students better. And it needs to come with some sort of strategic initiative from the top. And then we need at the bottom, we need faculty that are supporters, early adopters, people using it, willing to share their expertise and use cases with other faculty. And then hopefully between those two pushes and pulls, we can get the faculty who are a little bit more reticent to put this into practice. And for me, I think having a conversation with that one stat that over 90% of students were already using ChatGPT very shortly after it came out, you know, way back in 2022. Yep. So, you know, they are using it already. The question is, do we want educators, the people who are supposed to be teaching them how to think about this and retain their original thinking and you know, critical analysis, do we want educators leading that conversation, or what's happening right now? Do we want students operating in that black box area?
Well, just off the cuff, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the stat, I think it was 92% of students are reporting that they're using AI tools already. If faculty lag behind, in some respects, faculty become separated from and irrelevant to the conversation. We should be leading the way. And that's what we've argued repeatedly, is that If you don't help students understand how it can be used and how it can be applied and how it fits into the existing practices within a discipline, then ultimately you avoid some of the things that produces the fear, Amber, that you mentioned earlier, the fear response, which is over academic misconduct and sort of the hallucinations and those types of things. Ultimately, if we lead the way, we make ourselves relevant. If we don't, we become irrelevant. Because people,
I think it's ironic because by being afraid of the cheating, there is a void that the students will then fill with their own knowledge, which isn't much, right? So I've been teaching generative AI to college undergraduates, and we always start the course with, what are you using generative AI for? You know, let's talk about your use cases. What are your thoughts about how this works? What's it most helpful for? I'm sure that there is a percentage of those students who are thinking in their heads, oh, I use it to help me with assignments. I have had a student just outright say that first class. Mm-hmm. But more often, the predominant view of ChatGPT among undergraduates is they use it as a Google replacement. So mm-hmm. they're doing it to do what used to be Google searches. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that everyone in this room and listening to this podcast understands how undervaluing of the technology that is, right? So I try to over time shift their mindset to realize that actually it's a very powerful tool. And if you know how to prompt engineer and design a experience with it, you can actually use it to deepen your learning and deepen your understanding.
All right. And that's a very important way of looking at it. And those are things that we will come into more. So let's talk a little bit about teaching and course design, and then we'll get into the integrity part of it. Medium Post points out that attention will start coming up because generative AI can help people look like experts in seconds, but the real depth often isn't there. That's what's raising questions about authenticity. What do you feel about that?
I think it can make you look like an expert to a non-expert, perhaps. But if you're in the room with other experts, it's very clear that you don't know what you're talking about.
All right.
So one of the hooks that I try to talk about with students is to recognize that in the learning environment, if you strip away everything they think they're in college for, really what we come down to is to have knowledge about a subject matter. And mm-hmm. I've heard you talk about it on this podcast, that it's very important to be subject matter experts. That's what we're doing in higher ed. And so if you graduate and you've used generative AI to replace that subject matter expertise and shortcut that learning, and then you're hired for your perceived expertise, but you really don't have the depth of knowledge, how will you stay in that job? How will you continue to be employed? Because number one, you won't know how to properly evaluate the output that AI is giving you if you continue to use it in a subject matter that you are not the expert in. And number two, if you're simply using generative AI to do what someone has hired you to do, why do they need you? They could just use generative AI for that, right? If students are fearful about what their world will look like on the job market with AI, then they should realize we're all on the same page, right? Like, we want to work you through an engaged learning environment so that you become a subject matter expert. We want to teach you how to use AI properly so that you can properly and effectively evaluate the output so that you can be the true subject matter expert.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. And this is something that I tell my students as well. If you want to learn how to use a tool, you need to learn how the tool works before you start using that as a tool. I always ask the students, why are you here? Why are you coming to my class? Because whatever I'm talking about, ChatGPT can sing and dance for you all of this thing while you're sleeping. And it's always engagement. There's this aspect of humanity, emotions. I'm caring when I'm trying to instill this knowledge in them. I think these are some things that are, you know, still very important. And I think that keeps us human.
I agree. Yeah. And I think that there's also students in certain classes that just want to get a passing grade and get the credit for their degree. And so trying to make learning fun and more engaging, I think we do have a unique opportunity with AI to actually make that happen and wider the population of students who are actually interested in more than they originally thought they were.
I was just going to ask, what specific outcomes do you put in a syllabus? Like, you teach a class on generative AI, correct? How do you work this into the class in particular, because we're really talking about course design. How does that happen? What do you do?
Are you asking about teaching generative AI or how I would loop it into a non-generative AI topic?
I would say start with generative AI and then you go from there, right? We talk to a lot of faculty, not necessarily on this podcast, but a lot outside. Well, I'll put it this way. One guy in a meeting I was in not too long ago said, look, this is all great. I want four things that I should be doing. How do I make this happen in my class? So do you have any advice for somebody like that? Because I think that's really what they want to have.
What to put in your syllabus, I would be interested in what each of us is doing for that. But I believe that being very clear and explicit about the parts of the original thinking or creative thinking process that you are okay with them using AI for, and then in what ways are you expecting them to use AI? So for example, in my sales course that I teach, I do not want them using AI to help them draft the final report, but I'm okay with them giving their draft to AI and getting feedback on their writing style because I'm not teaching writing. So being explicitly clear with exactly where it's okay and where it's not so that the students have clear boundaries would be number one for the syllabus.
Right. And that's why I ask is because what you're doing there is you're actually teaching a method within the class. This is how you use AI. This is how you do not. And I think that's something that faculty, at least the ones I speak with, can sink their teeth into. I use it, just since you brought it up, what I will do is I will set very specific parameters on whatever they use it for. It can't be used for a final product or anything that's considered to be creative, but they're more than welcome to brainstorm with it. In the end, the paper that you submit can only include your thoughts, your ideas, well-sourced, well-cited. Bhaskar, you actually do something similar, right? How do you use it?
I make it very specific in my syllabus how I expect them to use generative AI. But before that, I kind of go through the class just to understand how comfortable students are with generative AI. Recently, in one of my classes, I took a poll and found out that there were many students who don't want to use generative AI in learning at all, which was very new to me. We need to consider that segment of people as well. But that's on us to kind of bring them up to speed too, because you can't live under a rock in this day and age. I have it in my syllabus that you will be told when to use generative AI. If you're not being told to use generative AI, don't. And more often than not, I'll probably have something built in the assignment. You have to go research and find out about this one thing that we did not talk in class and compare it with something that we did talk in class. And what are your thought processes? Like, why do you think that's true? And in my algorithms class, it's all about asking the whys. You've taken a decision. Wonderful. Why did you take that decision? So again, like, you know, just because AI does do a good job of explaining the whys, but it doesn't do a brilliant job at explaining the whys. And that's where I want my students to understand the whys.
Right. And I was going to say, to dovetail with that, one of the things we will do is we will tell them to use AI. And then part of the assignment is to print that out. And then they have to comment on the page they turn in everywhere that it disagrees with. So they have to start using it as a feature to say, yeah, this is more like Wikipedia, but these are the details that it missed. This is kind of how it gets it wrong.
Yeah, I would say another thing to update in the syllabus in the day of AI is the definition of what plagiarism is.
Right.
Because there's now a new definition that includes copying and pasting from generative AI. And I have found that students don't think about that unless you point it out. And they're very cognizant of academic dishonesty, the ramifications of that. And so spelling out that generative AI can actually be an author as well of things. Yeah. And you can't take that authorship and put it out as your own. That would be plagiarism.
That's wonderful that you brought it up. And people really don't think about that, but putting it explicitly in your syllabus would always be something awesome. With that being said, let's move on to our integrity part of it. We found out that OpenAI discontinued its text classifier for like low accuracy. So detectors are not like a standalone strategy. Recently, a Vox piece that I read suggests that cheating has not spiked. What has changed is the method of cheating. Students using AI often worry they'll be penalized unfairly, you know, as we've seen with limited or like unclear institutional policies. I read this post on Reddit the other day, and there was this teacher who said, enjoy the AI frameworks that help me do assessments. And it's, you know, it's able to spit out analytics and makes everything so much faster and so much accurate. So teachers are kind of okay with using AI, but, you know, the tough part is how do we show them that this AI is going to make life easier for you?
How do we show the teachers or
the teachers? Yeah. Hmm. The teachers, how, you know, this, we have this tool and, you know, if you kind of use this, it's going to make life much easier for you. And that's always kind of, I feel that's a push and pull kind of a situation, and just trying to find that balance too. You turn it in also now suppresses 1 to 19% AI indicators because of false positives. So, evidence should be holistic and it should be conversation first.
I think that any way you look at this conversation, there are similarities. Mm-hmm. Just like our students should be looking at, okay, I'm learning about this topic. What are parts of the learning process that I need to retain control over in order to not undermine my learning? In the situation of professors, faculty, instructors, we need to also be thinking about what are the parts of teaching that should stay under my control and why. It's also my favorite question is the question why. So I really like that you brought that up. So when we're giving feedback, for example, I think that should stay with us personally. I'd love to know your guys' opinion, but helping it do something that you might have a TA help you with, right? Like, I have an idea of what I want to evaluate for. Can you give me a rough draft of a rubric? And here's my parameters for that. See what it does. And then I find that no matter how you use generative AI, it does need to be iterative for you to get the best product. And so it's not a just copy and paste and I'm going to start using this, but it's using it as a launching pad for the things that don't undermine the outcome, right? So things like rubric generation. One of the things I've been loving this semester for my LMS, we use Canvas. I have been vibe coding with ChatGPT to redo the design of my homepage, my module overview, my assignment pages with HTML code. And then I literally put it into a HTML viewer on the browser to see what it looks like, make some tweaks. I can either make it directly into the HTML, or I can go back to the LLM and say, hey, with this button, can we change it to this color? Or can we make sure we link to this page instead? Once I get it perfect, I literally just copy and paste it into the coding form page of the LMS, and it looks amazing. It works great. And I think that it invites the students in to Canvas. It makes it visually engaging. Hopefully they'll be able to get around the Canvas page more. Maybe they will actually read the assignment instructions more, right? And so you can actually even collapse certain things. So when you click on it, it expands. So for example, on my assignment page at the very bottom, I say, if you want to get an A, here's how. And then they click it and it expands and it gives the high end of the rubric, right? I'm looking for this, I'm looking for this, I'm looking for this. But if I were to have that on just a regular page as a wall of words, it feels very overwhelming to the reader. And I think that students get confused when that happens. So using coding to have everything visually designed to be more engaging, I think, is one of the pro tips that I've been using AI for in my teaching.
I think that's a great idea. I may want to steal that. I like the idea of using it as an assistant too, because I have TAs, I have four of them, and there are things that I simply won't let them do, right? So honestly, I kind of treat AI that way. And I think students are on to you when you use AI to create a rubric and then just hand it to them. So I rarely do that. I think if faculty are going to use it in sort of a disingenuous way to get out of doing work, I think that creates a permissive environment for the student then to say, well, you did it too. Like, I learned it from you, Dad, you know, that old pot commercial, you know, that we've got to be better. And so we can't, on the one hand, kind of use it to shortcut our job and then turn around and turn everything into a Law and Order episode on their side.
I totally agree.
I mean, that's what it becomes. That's what it becomes.
Yeah. And I think, too, modeling the behavior that we expect of our students is very important. And science shows that over and over again. And I think modeling transparency, modeling accountability, right? So when I use AI, I'm very open about it. And I'm excited. I share that passion. I said, guys, I can't wait to get your feedback on the new Canvas design. I vibe coded it using ChatGPT. Let me know what you think. I've also used an AI-powered software called NVIDIA to create engaging cinematic little clips to set up a scenario that we're going to be doing in class. And I tell them, I say, hey, either I can read from the screen to set the scenario up for you, or we can watch this short 3-minute video that I made using AI. Check it out. Let me know what you think. And they love it, right? Right. So being very open and excited when you're using AI in ethical ways, I think is also helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I like the idea of the shorts. Since everybody's like, you know, scrolling through reels and scrolling through shorts, what if we can come up with assignment ideas where you can design videos in like shorts or reels and, you know, you just post it to the class. And this would be my $1 million idea. So if any of the LMS people out there want to steal this, don't forget me. I said it first. But make shorts out of...
They're stealing it.
Yeah, it's too late now. Yeah, just make shorts out of whatever you want to teach for the day. You know, just use that as like a refresher and just post it to them after class. So, you know, we've talked about this and, you know, here are a bunch of shorts that you can watch like whenever you're watching shorts.
I think we're at a turning point, you know, to your point where... We've been boxed in, and we've been boxed in so long by technology that we don't even realize it anymore. Right. We have an LMS, we have fields and buttons that we have to press on the back end. It's quite complicated. We're limited in what we can do. We have uploading file size limits, so we tend to require writing-based assessments. Yeah. And I think that instead of thinking about how can I use AI to help me with my existing process, I feel very passionate that instead we need to be thinking about if I could reinvent the learning environment, what would that look like? And then once you have that clear picture, think, how could I use AI to help me with that? And I think to both of your points, it wouldn't be doing, you know, discussion board posts and typing in front of a computer. Unless you're teaching that sort of class where that's the subject that you're teaching, of course. But for example, in sales, this is about, you know, role playing. It's about being put on the spot by other people. It's about reading body language. It's about speaking in a convincing manner. AI is great for that. You can do role playing using a chatbot with it. Super easy to make. Or you could actually have it look at you using the camera feature so it can see your body expression, right? You can even program it to tell the student what it's doing with its body language. And now I'm leaning forward. My eyebrows are furrowed, right? So even though we aren't there yet, and we will be soon, I'm sure, where the AI model has an avatar that we can see body language from, you can still get around that right now. So I would really encourage people listening to break out of this computer that we're sitting in front of day in and day out and get your students moving, get them out in the real world, get them engaging with their learning material in ways that just weren't possible before.
That is true. And I think it becomes more important as we get better with AI. Is, you know, having them to get out of that computer space and actually learn with, you know, start counting with your hands and toes kind of situation. And that kind of brings us, since we talked about assessments, and we can talk about assessments first and then get back to like, you know, what are your thoughts about misconduct or maybe guardrails are. So I went over a Cengage report, which said that 65% of students say that they know more about AI than their professors. And 55% of graduates feel unprepared to use these tools. That might be an opportunity if we kind of shift, you know, our assessments, the way we are centering our thinking, so we can align with what the students actually need. What do you think?
The one thing when you say that stat that I think of, right, is that you said
65% of students say that they know more about AI than their professors.
65% of students say they know more than their professors. But from my students in the Gen AI space, what they know is on the low end, which is telling you that the professor knowledge is even below that. Right? So we also need to be, again, that top down, bottom up approach. getting professors just experimenting. And I think breaking out of that mental mold where they see it as another technology because it's different. This is the first time we've had a technology that is taking things and doing things that we thought only humans could do.
All right.
The original thinking, the generation of new content, new music, new videos. This is something that you always had to have coming from a human, and now that's no longer. So even though it is a piece of technology, and we've been through pieces of technology in academia before, like the internet, the calculator, right? It is also different. And so we need to be thinking about it differently.
Anything you want to add, Sean, to that?
No, I was just actually thinking through everything. And I keep going back to the paranoia and the sort of dealing with misconduct and the sort of modeling appropriate behavior. But I'm hung on that stat, 65%. Amber's point that the professors really have to be way low. And part of the thing I'm reflecting on, not to just rehash it, is I read something the other day. I think it was a CEO or some exec with Procter & Gamble was asked about AI. And they said that the real distinction that is coming and starting to be present now, but really going to be important in the next 5 years, is that while everybody floods into the AI space and starts to use it, the big difference will be between those who know how to use it and then everybody else.
Agreed.
And so as we're thinking about this and trying to model, et cetera, I'm just thinking in terms of what would the institutional response look like that? Obviously, part of it would be training for students, right? Trying to get faculty on board to model appropriate use. But that throws all of our misconduct stuff out the window at that point. I don't know. I mean, I'm up here just floating around thinking about this stuff right now. So
yeah, well,
I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think?
It's not a direct answer to what you're saying, but it is adjacent. One of the things that I've been thinking about recently is every time I hear conversations about misconduct and how do we spot this, I think about the fact that cheating, and Bhaskar started with us, cheating is nothing new. It's been happening for quite a long time, right? And so I think that it would be worthwhile as academics and researchers to think about what empirically do we know about the motivations for cheating? Why are we continuing? And I think, Sean, you've talked about this on past episodes. Why are we continuing to look at how to catch it and not moving earlier in the pipeline to how to prevent it, right? And I think in order to do that from a social psychologist standpoint, we need to be thinking about what are the motivations, why are people deciding to cheat in that very moment, and how can we design a learning environment that either eliminates or prevents that?
Well, we do know some of that. I mean, you know, in terms of education, there are all sorts of other spaces where somebody might cheat or break a rule. But in educational spaces, things like the students don't perceive the particular assignment to be of high value or important to the subject matter. Also, the time frame compression. There are external factors that have to do with the degree to which students are pressed by other issues in their lives. For instance, a lot of our students work. They run out of time, et cetera. And so there are things that we can control within the educational space, and there are things we can't. And I think one of the things we can control is actually trying to get away from the low stakes, busy work kinds of activities like discussion boards and move it back into the sort of formative, substantially important, linked directly to the material kinds of assignments where it requires them to think creatively and not answer quickly. So then you can give them space to use AI to brainstorm rather than just generate an answer. I don't know of any practical way to do it yet other than to do some of the things we've already mentioned, which is try to come up with reflective assignments and where they have to apply material and do things like that. But you have to make it worth their effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm finding scaffolding is very helpful in my courses. Yeah. And necessary from a number of standpoints you mentioned, and I've heard this when students talk about their challenges. Essentially, time management is a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think by forcing them in some ways to do manageable pieces of the work each week, for example, or whatever makes sense to the mm-hmm. course, I think is helpful. And giving them formative feedback. I know that research shows positive learning outcomes from formative feedback, which means that it's not going to tank their grade if they did something wrong on a formative assignment, but the feedback is what's critical, and it's building to a bigger assessment where they will get graded, but by then they've had your one-on-one coaching. So in my sales class, and to a minor extent in my generative AI class as well, I do scaffolding where I have a project. There's two per course that they're working on. For example, one is a group project where they simulate a sales team, and they pick a real product or service offering that exists in the world, and they develop a sales strategy around it. Each week, they need to put a section of the final report into the report draft. So one week, mm-hmm. they're researching the company and they're researching the offering. The second week, they're developing the unique value proposition. The third week, they're researching the target market and deciding what personas or market segments that can be broken into and how might they sell to each of those segments. And so each week in the class, I am designing an in-class exercise that's formative, that gets them thinking, engaging, talking with their peers, getting feedback, giving them space that they might not take outside of class to think through mm-hmm. things. And then they have to turn in a form to me so that I can see their thinking and their engagement from the class. I give feedback on it. I let them see the feedback, but it's not graded. And then each week mm-hmm. they submit a new section of the report. It's for points, but it's low points. And I give specific feedback on that. And then each week we do the same thing until by week 10, the report's done. And then the grade is really about, did you incorporate the feedback? Did you show growth, right? So I found mm-hmm. that works really well, scaffolding it, and also getting them to show their original thought that I know is original in class through something that's low stakes. Mm-hmm. If you don't do the in-class exercise, which is what happened to me last semester, I was doing everything, but I wasn't doing these in-class exercises where they submitted something that had their original thought. What happens is you get the weak report, and now that you suspect is AI, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so by having them do in-class either, you know, discussions, oral defenses, just a worksheet they fill out, something low stakes where you can capture their original thinking and you know it's there, then you can use that as a baseline for what they turn in later.
Yeah, and that really makes sense. Yeah.
So, yeah, I like that. I mean, that's I was just going to say, that's process, right? Because in a world of AI, if we just stay product focused, that's an incentive to just use AI as well, because that's all it's going to do. So, you know, if you bundle together all the issues students face, managerial issues, et cetera, and then you put them in a space where you just have to have a paper. Yeah, I might use AI for that. Yeah.
Well, on top of that, like, humans are procrastinators anyways. So we'll wait till the last moment. So whenever we're towards the end, you know, you just want something in there. And that's when we end up using ChatGPT or any help that we can get, honestly. And I'm moving on to like mm-hmm. your thoughts about misconduct and guardrails, because getting into AI too fast can draw some heat as well, because there are other people who might mm-hmm. think that, well, you know, we are eroding our core values of critical thinking, struggle, and ethical growth. And, you know, we need guardrails, so we can't really offload all of this teaching to AI. What would be a due process that you could recommend where somebody can, or institution can work with AI and not against it?
Hmm. So on an institutional level, what the guardrails might be? That's such a tough question to answer, because I think it depends on the course.
Right.
And that's where academic freedom comes in. For the faculty and in each course. Like, for example, my guardrails in a creative writing class are going to be completely different than in a finance class, for example, right? And mm-hmm. so I think at the institutional level, you need to design guardrails that are broad enough that it can fit with all of the course requirements. Mm-hmm. On an institutional level, I think one of the first things you need to do, again, is go back to that academic dishonesty policy and update that to reflect all of the ways that AI now could be used as another author. So when we're talking about plagiarism, when we're talking about cheating, it's not just from online sources or from your peers or published books, right? Yeah. Now it's also from generative AI. So I think that's the first place to start. And then I think looking at the policies, and I know Sean, actually, aren't both of you very involved with this? So I should be asking you these questions. But then I think, you know, looking at the steps that take the process that they go through, seeing how that needs to now include the possibility of AI use. And I think that also, again, if in today's space, there is a gap between the university, the faculty and the student use, right? So we can't fault students at this point in time. This might change next semester or next year. We can't fault students for exploring AI in the absence of any direction.
Yeah, no, I don't blame them at all. And I think you're pointing to some of the difficulties we've had in trying to come up with processes. We have existing academic misconduct processes, but the problem is that, you know, if you want to source it to one specific place, faculty have to have a policy in their syllabus about AI. And then you have to have a system in place that allows for the complete overwhelming nature of the reports of what's going to happen relative to AI. And the bureaucracy is going to be slow. So honestly, we're still trying to get our heads around it. We're not exactly sure how you write a policy and then how you write an actual procedure that could be quick enough to keep up with multiple instances of this, even within the same student. So I think the best thing you do is you do what we've talked about on the front end, is you try to get it from both directions. You model the appropriate behavior, you set guidelines for faculty administrators, and then hopefully on the back end, the misconduct doesn't catch all these cases, which honestly, I think many of them are going to be just innocent misuse. They're, you know, it's like you're pointing out, Amber, they're just using it. I mean, because it's another tool and they were unclear on how to use it to begin with. So yeah, in terms of due process, the best thing you can do is just try to be transparent and make sure they know what the right and wrong answer is. Universities are way behind on that.
The universal piece that every university and every course needs to protect is the critical thinking and is the original thought. So if you wanted to think about at an institutional level, you know, having an outsourcing of the critical thinking piece, of the original thought piece, be prohibited, I think that's an easy place to start. And that's why I say the academic dishonest policy is hitting upon that, right? With no plagiarism, no cheating. I just think that we need to broaden the way we're thinking about what's the goal of that academic dishonesty policy? What's the role of a university in teaching these students and equipping these students? And again, I think it goes back to we're trying to develop subject matter experts. In order to do that, we need to have them thinking with their own thoughts, right, first before they use a tool to help improve their thinking. That's okay, I feel like. But it needs to start with their own thoughts, and then they need to be able to critically think. And I think in terms of something you could do to assess whether someone has used it dishonestly or in an unethical manner is, we've mentioned this, but the oral defense, right? If you say that you understood this topic or this assignment and this is what you submitted, then sit down and explain it to me. What was your process? How did you get these research sources? How did you develop the strategy? Why is this your opinion? And oftentimes, and we've heard it on the show before, students at that point say, you know, I use ChatGPT, I can't explain. And then we can actually do the hard work to teach them about how we can use it more ethically.
I was just going to dovetail in and say that a lot of those techniques, you know, I was using a lot of that stuff in advance of AI. I would get a student who would submit a paper, clearly plagiarized, and it's like, all right, we need to talk. And they would come in, they'd have to talk me through the paper. They'd have to define terms. I'd say, well, that's an awful big word. Why don't you tell me what that means? And you would inevitably catch them. I had a couple of students once upon a time who, you know, showed up and it was clearly the same paper. And so it's kind of like, okay, let's see how this works. You prisoner's dilemma them, right? But I think all that still starts with the faculty member essentially putting something in their syllabus that says this is what's going to be fair game. So I think Amber's onto something, though, I think, with the whole notion of what is the creative part? What is the part that's going to be central, critical thinking or whatever? That should be part of whatever's in the syllabus AI policy as well. And then ultimately, it's up to the faculty member at that point to kick them into academic misconduct or not, because that's right. How it starts. Mm-hmm. I know I'm kind of spitballing a policy together, mostly because we're in the middle of writing one, but go ahead.
Yeah, I do like the concept, and perhaps I heard it on this show last season, that it's more about the trend of use, right? In this time mm-hmm. where things are more ambiguous to the students, it's not that you used it in this mm-hmm. one class, but I think that something right. should be triggered if you used it across classes and across time, even after you've been talked to about mm-hmm. this.
Yep,
and right. And that's one of the things we're trying to get our heads around, because we're creating a repository of instances of student misconduct, mm-hmm. trying to see by student if there's a pattern in any kind of misconduct, because that would play a role in the kind of academic misconduct response or procedure that would occur relative to the most recent event. So the problem with AI, I think, at this point is that, and we've seen this at our university, every time somebody uses AI, they report them. And so you've got a backlog of these AI cases, and you've got students with multiple AI instances without any sort of moment of us saying, well, maybe you shouldn't have done that. There's no instruction side. There's just punishment side. There's a stick and no carrot at this point. That's right. I think that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. But then moving on, like, you know, here's the dilemma. Like, you know, we still want to use AI as teaching assistants, right? There's this workforce angle, and it's called right. agentic AI. And so anybody who's listening, and think of a downloadable employee, if you would. That would manage your calendar, that would manage your workflow, would be an easy way of explaining agentic AI. And that is on the rise. And it promises efficiency, but, you know, it also underscores why humans still matter. Leadership, empathy, ethical judgment, and a global study of AI's impact on jobs shows that AI actually increases demand for complementary human skills, like digital literacy, teamwork, resilience by up to 50%. So, you know, that's where education kind of steps in. AI as a teaching assistant would really work. Again, like, you know, if you pair it with a human, it can really work. And I remember, Amber, I think you were the first one I heard say that you used a chatbot for your syllabus.
Yes.
And you want to talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Sean, you asked what are four things that professors should do today, and that would be on my list. Is create mm-hmm. a chatbot for your syllabus. It's incredibly easy. And I think I've had the most success mm-hmm. this semester with launching that. I've had it now for two semesters, but it didn't get much use last semester. This semester, I mentioned it in class. The very beginning of the class, I do this little fun quiz on Menti that people can do on their phones, and the winner gets 1 point of extra credit. So it just makes it fun. And one of my questions on the first day of class, it tends to be about like course structure and the takeaways that I want them to have. For example, my contact preference. And one of them is about if you have a question and it's about the course design, where's the first place that you should go? And some of the answers that they could have chosen one were the syllabus, a peer, the professor, and the syllabus chatbot, right? So it was just kind of shocking to the class because they chose everything but syllabus chatbot. And then when the right answer was a syllabus chatbot, there was a whole verbal reaction of the room. They were very shocked by this and kind of excited, I get the sense. And so I said to them, I said, if you have a simple question that is related to something that would be gone over in the syllabus, go there first, bookmark it on your browser. And I said, honestly, if you send me an email that I think could be answered by my chatbot, I want to test out my chatbot. So I'm going to copy and paste your email into my chatbot and I'm going to see what it says. And if it's good, I'm going to copy and paste that back out and give it to you. And so they all laughed, right? So I think, you know, loosening us up with using AI and realizing that it's going to be used for, you know, things that don't matter, like a question that could be asked by reading the syllabus, I think makes it, it sets a tone, I think, for the semester. And now whenever anyone has a question, I can just say, well, go ask the chatbot, right? And it does a really good job. And it words things really well, right? So if you get a email at 9 p.m. at night and you're tired and you have other things going on in your life, you have to then be patient and show empathy and support, right? You can build all that into the chatbot. Mm-hmm. So it can be infinitely patient with your students. And then I link to it from my Canvas homepage. It's linked to in the syllabus. And so I think it's a great resource to have.
Mm-hmm. At what point would you think you'd find that one disgruntled student who would be like, well, my professor doesn't care enough to reply to my emails. She just sends me to a chatbot.
Yeah. I would be surprised if that happens because I'm quick to answer questions about the assignment, for example. I have a clarifying question about this assignment. Should I do this, right? Mm-hmm. Or if someone's going to be absent. And in fact, the chatbot it's been designed by me to refer them to ask me if they start hitting upon certain parameters where I would want to be in the loop. But one of my favorite things is if they have any question that's related to the LMS, it will work them through troubleshooting, just like a tech support would. And if it gets to a point where it can't figure it out by searching the website and trying to problem solve it itself, it will direct them to call the Canvas hotline and remind them that it's open 24/7.
That's awesome.
And then afterwards, it will ask them, what did the tech person say? And it will make sure that the problem's resolved. And if it wasn't, they'll help the student form an email, including getting a screenshot for me, so that when I get it, it's already been vetted. I know it's something on my end, and I have a screenshot showing me exactly where to go to fix the problem in the LMS. So that's been my favorite part of it.
That's super cool.
I think I'm going to do that too next semester. I'm stealing all
a bunch
ideas.
Of your ideas.
That's right. I'm stealing your idea that you were talking about with LMSs too, Bhaskar.
Well, now moving on, let's talk a little bit about hiring and workforce mirror before we kind of talk about tools and kind of close and wrap up. So one of our clear signals in the job market is how employers want AI fluency to be made visible, right? So some universities are actually posting like eligible certificates right on their transcripts right now. And there are some micro-credentials that are being offered for digital badges. So that choice matters because a recruiter scanning through an official transcript is far more likely to kind of notice all of these credentials and, you know, than a badge that's buried under a portfolio. So what would you think, how important is it to have all of this on a piece of paper? I think I read it on Reddit, and I do scroll on Reddit a lot. It said, where a recruiter said that, show me a project where you have used AI responsibly in context, and I'll skip half the technical grilling. So it was that straightforward. It kind of tells us a lot. So like, what are your thoughts? Like, you know, what kind of portfolio artifact do you think would be the best for a student to have, prospective student to have?
Yeah, I think it's important to preface every podcast, I feel like, that involves AI with saying what we're talking about is relevant to today, and it might change next month or in a year, right?
Or tomorrow.
Right, exactly, yeah. But today's answer is, I think, similarly to what are some top low-hanging fruit, simple, straightforward things that professors can do. This is the answer to low-hanging fruit, something universities, colleges should do tomorrow, actually yesterday, to be honest with you, is they should be offering some sort of transcript-bearing micro-credentials immediately. And as the Florida conference showed, you can do that simply by introducing three courses. If UF, with their thousands of students, can do that multidisciplinary, then your college can do that too. It's quite simple. So I think that needs to be happening immediately. And I do think it's important. And I think that it's one thing to say, oh yeah, I learned, I took a class about that. But I think it's another thing to have it specifically on your transcript or to have a certificate that vouches for your knowledge of AI.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. I mean, you really need that something to vouch for your knowledge. And, you know, that's the whole reason behind degrees. And yeah, sorry, go for it, Sean.
Well, I was going to say, I go back to, it was at the Florida conference. The guy from NVIDIA actually said, it doesn't matter what you major in now, as long as you also major in AI, right? That everybody needs to major in AI. If there's a way to actually tie that to the credentialing process through the degree or even in the transcript or whatever, I think that's going to be something we're going to have to consider here at our university.
For me, it's a no-brainer. Students want this. They're clamoring for it, actually. I had a student this past semester who wanted me to do an independent study with him. And I just didn't have the bandwidth. And I was like, why do you want this so badly? And he said, I already have a job lined up for after graduation and my future employer wants me to take this course. Right. Yeah. So, and I have someone yesterday, a student from last semester in my sales course said, Dr. Yu, when will my college be releasing that Gen AI course that you were talking about? Right. So the students want this. They want it so badly. The employers want it. We need to be implementing this. And I think that part of what we've been talking about today, and it's so important, is because we aren't really doing enough or doing it sufficiently, students are operating in this gray zone when it comes to AI, and that's being reflected on the job market, actually. Mm-hmm. So in my off time from teaching, I run a business. We're currently hiring. And this is the first wave of hiring where I've had to revamp my hiring process, similarly to how we're having to revamp teaching in the classroom to protect the process from AI being used as a shortcut. I just had a phone call yesterday with a candidate where I start with an online form that they fill out to get them to tell me a little bit more about their experience with tasks and responsibilities specific to the job that wouldn't necessarily be on their resume. One of the sections of the form is computer skills. And one of the questions is, what's the most advanced thing you know how to do with Word, for example? And if I see a paragraph of an answer now, I immediately have a flag go up. If I see an M-dash, that flag stays up, right?
Yeah, M-dash.
If I see that they know how to do mail merges and insert table of contents and do complex stuff, you know, usually AI has consistent things that it likes to mention when it answers one question. Same thing with Excel. If I see a VLOOKUP function and the word pivot table, my AI, you know, spidey senses are tingling. And so then what happens is I get them on a phone call. We talk about other things, but then I say, okay, hey, what's the most advanced thing you know how to do with Word? If it doesn't match what they said on their online interview, that's odd. And so then I say, okay, do you know how to do a mail merge? And I know that they put that they know how to do it on the online interview, but they usually just have totally forgotten about that. And they say, no, I don't think I've ever done that.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because I have one candidate who actually would have passed my computer questions if just even without that dishonesty, right? If she had just been authentic about her knowledge, she would have passed to the next round. But now I have this interesting ethical question. Is that the type of person that I want on my team? Because now my trust in her resume, what her resume says, her other answers, what she's telling me, the trust is now undermined across the board. And if you're using AI and you aren't vouching for what it's saying about you as a professional and what you know, that's alarming.
True. Yep. And those are valid points.
I agree.
It speaks a lot about you. Yeah. Yep. So if you're using a tool, to everybody out there, read what it's writing about you and make sure it's correct. Because
you have to vouch for the output.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Fibbing can only get you that far. There will be a point where you will be caught. Well, it is true.
No, it's true. I mean, one of my secrets is that I worked in the private sector for years, and we would always, I worked in an accounting department for a corporation that owned more land in the state of California than the state of California. And you get these people who had fluffed their resumes and they'd come in saying, oh, well, I could do this, that, and the other. And, you'd say, all right, and we always hire on a probationary period. And, you know, within a couple of weeks, you knew that that person knew nothing about whatever it was. And that's, I tell my students that in my classes now, particularly the more advanced statistics classes, I say, look, don't bullshit around. I mean, you're going to get caught. You really need to know this.
Yeah. And I think that might be a very beautiful outcome of AI, because it started with having us question the authenticity of something. And I think one of the outcomes of all of this might be that actually we redesign things to ensure that we have that authenticity. Authenticity is actually going to be much more important, much more valuable, and much more scrutinized, I think.
Right.
And the people who are authentic with their use of generative AI, I think will succeed.
I agree. And it, you know, truth becomes a very precious commodity. That's one of the things we covered with Angela and this whole hallucinations, et cetera. I think this could be a method by which authenticity becomes more important.
Right. And that kind of leads us to the tools that are available. I know Blackboard uses a bunch of different AI tools out there. So, you know, you have the rubric. I know, Amber, you talked about the rubric generation, the assignment generation. It gives you ideas about, you know, how you can reform your assignments. So what kinds of tools have you seen that are out there?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many. And for those who don't know much about the AI space, usually they're built off of the frontier models. So, for example, Perplexity, which I would recommend replacing Google with Perplexity. Sorry, Google. they are using the backbone of GPT from OpenAI. So they're currently using GPT-5, for example. Mm-hmm. So they're often using the same models you would get from, you know, the top five research labs that are doing this. But I use Perplexity a lot. I've recently started using Whisper. It doesn't have an H in the name, to help me do voice to text so much better than any other voice to text that you've tried. It's amazing. I'm using NVIDIA with an I-N-V-I-D-E-O to help do cinematic videos for my classes to introduce them to scenarios. I prefer ChatGPT. The benchmark kind of goes back and forth, but ChatGPT tends to continually outpace someone at some point. I like Claude for writing. Mm-hmm. I love Google Notebook LM for creating podcasts. It's amazing. I also love on Google Audio, Gemini AI Studio. Have you been on that?
Yeah.
Gemini AI Studio. Okay.
I've looked at it.
A feature.
It's the Google AI Playground, right? I think that's what you're talking about.
I think they just changed the name because I tried to Google the Playground very recently, and now it's called the Studio, the AI Studio.
Okay, Google AI Studio. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is correct. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a feature you can choose, and it can see your screen, which, of course, we have some data privacy concerns there, so be cognizant of that. But it can see your screen, and if you let it look at what you're looking at on the browser, if you have trouble figuring out where to go on a website, for example, or any issues with, like, the UI, it can see what you're seeing, and you can talk to it. So the audio is working on your computer. You could say, hey, I can't figure out where to go to change my reservation for this. Can you help me? And it says, it looks like you're looking at the homepage of so-and-so restaurant. On the top left, I see a dropdown that says change date. Can you click on that for me? And I really think I haven't heard anyone say, when everyone's talking about, like, what jobs are going to be eliminated, I haven't heard anyone say as often as they should be saying that tech support at call centers should be eliminated. We should all be moving to this technology tomorrow, right? Also, 11 Reader is another good voice generator. And so you could take, for example, a really good Reddit thread, Bhaskar, where all the comments are saying all the different things. Take the URL for that link, put it into 11 Reader and have it create a podcast. It's fascinating the important points or the themes that it brings up. And it will even bring up things that you know, technically it's a hallucination, things that are related but weren't mentioned. But I fact-checked them before because it mentioned a historical event as an example to a point that someone was making. I fact-checked it, and it was a real event that really did happen and really was relevant to the conversation. So that was fascinating.
So those RAG models are really working its wonders at this point. So everything's fact-checked and everything has context, and it's really cool. Would you like to add anything to that, Sean, before we kind of wrap up?
No, I think we've gotten a lot of good tips and good advice. And, I'm kind of processing it all because some of it I'm familiar with. Like, what did you say, 11 reader? What was That's what it's called. I'm not familiar with that one. I might check that one out. The Whisper, I haven't really looked at. I'd read about it somewhere, but that would be useful even in the classroom in terms of people with, for instance, certain accommodations that you have to meet. They'll leave recorders or something. You could just say, all right, well, I'll record it and then I'll translate the lecture for you and just share it that way. I mean, I'm just thinking of other ways to use the stuff. So
yes,
that's also, all I have to add at this point.
You reminded me there's also Descript that is a video editing software that is AI powered. So if you're recording a lecture, for example, for like a flipped classroom or just because you want someone to have access to a recorded lecture, you can upload your recording there or take it directly there. And it transcribes it, first of all, so you can see what you said. And it looks like, just think about like a Word document on the page. Any edit you make to the transcription through that Word document pane, so to speak, it actually edits the video.
Oh, wow. That's kind of cool too.
And it has-
So to just drop a segment or whatever, and it literally just redoes the video.
Exactly. And it has the underlord button. So you can have it do different things like identify all of your filler words, which I'm very guilty of. And then it will just remove it. Or if you have a long pause, you can have it automatically shorten those to be like three seconds. So that's been quite useful and saved me a lot of time when I'm recording lectures.
I think, you know, just as we move forward toward the close, I think, you know, the real thing to remember, and this is mostly for faculty, and I tell them this a lot, you know, you just start with one thing. I typically recommend notebook because that's the most sort of, it's not as frightening as everything else and you have more control. But you start with one change and just remember, you're always in the loop. You can't just automate it. You have to stay in the loop, particularly when you do it right. So as a closing, that's sort of the advice I would offer, I guess.
Yeah. And I think for faculty, I think I'll use this from Ethan Mollick, who spoke at the Academy of Management a couple of years ago. He said at his session, just invite AI to the table. Just invite it to the table. And I really took that to heart. And I think that's how I've become the kind of power user that I am today. Mm-hmm. Because whenever I had a question in my head or something that I wanted to do that I wasn't really thrilled about or something I was puzzling over, I was like, let me invite AI to the table and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful way of putting it. And if there's one takeaway that I, from this conversation that I have with you guys is, don't wait. So start small, but start now. Right. So
I love that.
Just don't wait.
Start now.
I think that would be something that I totally take away from this. But with that being said, thank you so much
for
taking time out. This conversation was wonderful. Again, this is episode one of season two. So we're super excited to have you as our first guest for season two. Thank you so much for making time. This conversation was wonderful. I cannot.
Of course. Thank you so much. This was wonderful as well.
Thank you for
my time. Thank you.
Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks. We will see you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was wonderful, right? Yeah.
I learned a lot too. I mean, that's why if it looks like it, occasionally I'm pausing, I'm thinking, wait a minute, I need to think about that. So
learning moments from here. So I leave the listeners with a quick closing thought. So the common thread across everything we've discussed isn't fear, it's intentionality. AI really won't transform higher ed on its own, but you know, if we use it thoughtfully in our structures, in our teaching, in our assessment, in our daily practices, we can make learning more rigorous, more personal, and more human. And to our listeners, again, if you're enjoying these conversations, please help us keep them going by supporting the show at buymeacoffee.com/AI what the tech. Every coffee fuels our ideas and keeps the podcast buzzing. And as always, you can find us on Spotify, Spotify, Apple Music, any of your major podcasting platforms. Mm-hmm. And that is it from us.
That's a wrap.
Thank you so much for joining us.
We'll see you next time.
See ya. Bye.